How's it going, everybody? Chris Block here, thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com, here on this Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, here with another edition of Puck Chatter Radio. We're back again. And the last one, which was our first in 5 years, I can't even believe. When I thought about it, I couldn't even believe that it was 5 years, but it was. But we got a good enough response. Some people listened to it. Some people liked it. Other people listened, maybe. I don't know. but enough that we decided that we were going to do another one. I don't know how many of these we're going to do. But for now, we're enjoying it. And earlier today, I had a chance to talk to, once again, our friend Al Simaglia, at Al Simaglia on Twitter. Al and I, for those of you that recall, former and maybe future veterans, curmudgeons of the Chicago Blackhawks blogging community, I guess, whatever that's worth. Al and I try to pick up where we left off last time, which was really talking about the future or the fate of the 2021, I guess we should call it, the 2021 NHL season. There's hopes that'll begin here in the beginning of January, but a lot has got to happen before that can take place, and we'll talk about that. And then we're going to get into a discussion, which was news that dropped the day after that we did this first podcast in years, which if you listen to that show, we kind of had an inkling something was about to go down. We didn't know exactly what, but the Blackhawks, the day after this last podcast, back on October 20th, I think, dropped news that sent a letter to season ticket holders that they were going to be honest with their fans from this point forward in the media, or transparent. And they announced that they were in the middle of a rebuild that they had formerly not been honest about. and then Stan Bowman went on a media tour. And what we're specifically going to talk about in the second half of today's podcast was an interview that Stan did with The Athletic. He did a bunch of them, but the one that we're going to talk about is the one that he did with Scott Powers and Mark Lazarus of The Athletic on October 20th. And we're going to kind of go get through as much of that and hit the points with Al. And without any further ado, here's my conversation earlier today with Uncle Al.
Al Simaglia on the line again. Al, I think that was pretty apropos that we would do a show, we would wait 5 years for our comeback, and then within 24 hours, the Blackhawks make our obsolete, or our podcast obsolete with fresh news.
Yeah, it's very fitting. Very fitting. Not a shock. Interesting times all the way around. We got a little catching up to do.
Yes, we do, and we're gonna try to do it. Back in the day, we would do these marathon podcasts. We're gonna try not to do that. I don't think people have attention span for that anymore. So we're going to try to get this done in just under 60 minutes today. And we're going to talk about, if you've been following along this NHL, potential NHL 2020-2021 season, the next 2 weeks are make it or break it, basically, for the league. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But we're also, the news that we've been referencing, it's a little old now, but that's what we do here. We take our sweet time, and we're old now. We could take our sweet time in analyzing things and talking about them in a formal way on a podcast. But Stan Bowman, I think it was like October 20th or something, went and did a so-called transparency tour after the Blackhawks sent a letter to their season ticket holders, basically coming out and stating formally for the first time that they were in the process of a rebuild. And we'll talk about that. I have some thoughts. but Stan Bowman went out, and Blackhawks claiming now that they're going to be transparent, or as transparent as possible, with the fans and the media. And he went around, he did some interviews, and the one that we're going to talk about specifically, because we could jump around and but that would get confusing. So if you want to follow along, or if you want to listen to one specific, I think probably the best one, and with no disrespect to anybody else, but probably the best one is the one The Athletic did with Scott Powers and Mark Lazarus. Maybe someone would argue with me, but for the purpose of this podcast, we're going to we're going to go through that one and as much as we can try to go item by item and talk about that. But first, Al, the NHL is in the process of determining whether or not they're going to be able to have a 2020-21 season. And it's going to be tough because if you read between the lines here, some of the things that have leaked out, and I think Scott Burnside had an article recently that had some information. There's been a couple of podcasts. I know Eugene Melnick, the owner of the Ottawa Senators, did a podcast the other day. Little things are leaking out here and there. And if you try to connect the dots, there's some key things that everybody needs to keep in mind. Number one, owners seem to not have an appetite for anything less than a 60-game season. That's number one. Number two, as of right now, the Japan, the country of Japan, and NBC are going forward with the Olympics that were supposed to happen last summer but got knocked out because of COVID. They are going ahead with that in the summer of 2021. So NBC, being the NHL's primary broadcast partner, is going to be unavailable to the NHL come July. So if you're the NHL, you have until the end of June, basically, or July 4th, maybe, to get your season in. So that means this. In order to accomplish these two things, in order to have a normal playoff and in order to have at least a 60-game season, the NHL is going to have to begin their season no later than the first week of January. Right now, their target is January 1st. It's coming up because you got to get some of these players that are in Europe. You got to get them over. You got a lot of things to settle. But here's the important point that I got to make. And this is just these are just facts and logistics. If you're going to do a 60 game season, you have to start the first week of January, and that means you're playing four games a week. Not four games one week and two the next. You are playing four games a week from the first week of January to about the end of April. That gives you a 60 or a 64-game season. And then the last week of April or the first week of May is when you can begin your postseason. That gets you – that accomplishes those two things. That accomplishes at least a 60-game season and a full playoff and gets it done by the time the Olympics begin. Can they do it, Al?
Doesn't seem that way. I mean, you know, going by what you said, you laid it out nicely. I don't know the full ramifications of the commitment to the Olympics, you know, and how that disrupts everything concerning TV coverage and things like that. But let's just pretend for a minute that you're going to start on January 1st. Realistically, players should be ready to go the end of October, right after U.S. Thanksgiving, no later than the first couple of games of December. You know, there needs to be a training camp. So, I mean, I don't hear any strong talk of, you know, players being notified or having an idea when this is going to start. I was always of the belief that they could delay it, but that wasn't considering the Olympics. You know, if we push the Olympics aside, starting later, like, for example, starting in the beginning of February or the middle of February, there's no football to compete with. The Super Bowl's done. You know, hockey could get a little bit more attention maybe. But, again, how many games can they fit in? There's a lot of moving parts to this. The other thing is how many people could attend these games in certain states. And unless they do some sort of a bubble format again where they're using basically a couple of states and Canada for whatever goes on there, there's going to be different rules for different places, it seems like. It could very well be. We don't know. You know, right now, I drive – down in my town, and I see some places still having people inside to eat food, restaurants. And then other places, not so. And that's just – that's within the state. So you could imagine, you know, there's going to be different guidelines set for what capacity these buildings could be at. That's one big thing. The other thing is, beside what you already just said, the other thing is, do the Blackhawks want to open the United Center up if they could only put 4,000 or 5,000 people in there? It costs a lot of money to open the building up. I don't know if it, you know, I don't know if they've come to that understanding amongst themselves, and whether they have to reach a certain amount of attendance where it's worthwhile. This is almost like it's lose a little or lose a lot, or lose less and lose more situation. So that's another thing to consider. And then it's revenue sharing and splitting and everything else. You may have a situation where the Tampa Bay Lightning could have a near capacity crowd, and here we're at 5,000 people. So there's just so much there that I don't see how it could start. I think the January 1st was – I think that's really out the window. The part about the 60 games, that's going to be interesting. I'm thinking maybe 48 or 42 might be more realistic.
I mean, I could see – so the quote that I saw, and I believe it was in the Burnside article, was – there was, I believe, an unnamed member of the NHL board was saying that the belief is that the NHL will need to play at least 60, you know, in the neighborhood of 60, 70 games to satisfy sponsors and broadcast partners and then have a full postseason. So, I mean, this is all going to come down to your point. This is all going to come down to money. And basically, it's going to come down to how much money are the owners willing to lose. And that's big picture. When you start, like, you know, getting down, it's like we talked about last time, what you're talking about, you have the different attendances and capacities and different cities. You're potentially going to have a scenario where some municipalities may not even allow their, like, look at New York City. Is New York City going to allow the Madison Square Garden to open? I don't know that they are. Like, even to play right in an empty arena, I don't know that they are. So you have that to figure out. And you already have a situation where it looks like the Canada border is going to remain closed. So you're going to have a Canada, you know, all the Canadian teams are going to play each other. You're going to have a lot of 2- and 3-game series, so Vancouver and Montreal aren't flying cross country all the time, which is, you know, that creates a different situation, but it is what it is. I mean, Montreal is going to fly out west, probably play 3 games in Vancouver, 2 in Edmonton, 2 in Calgary, and then fly back home. You know, it's a season
like an
to have
schedule almost.
Yeah, it's a season to have a season. You know, it's not going to be, you know, your most balanced or, it'll be a season with an asterisk. I mean, again, and it's greed that's going to stand at the forefront here. But this is going to come down to, and what I see happening here is that you know, this is eerily similar to me of how the NHL behaves before a lockdown, before they lock out the players, is that they're talking, you know, real big that, yeah, we're going to get the season in. We're moving forward. This is definitely going to happen. We're doing everything that we can. And then at the very last minute, they throw it in the player's lap and say, oh yeah, by the way, you're going to have to do an extra 35% rollback on your contracts. And then the players are left sitting there with the whole season hinging on whether or not they're going to be the ones to cough up the money, basically. That's where this seems to all be going to me, because – and people will point out, well, the players already have a 20% escrow and they agreed to a 10% deferment. Okay, but that's not enough. That's not enough. The NHL and locally and nationally – and internationally do not get enough money from their television partners and sponsorships to fund a season without fans. And then to your point, you have a whole other mess. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, here's the other side that the only leverage the players have is that I think the owners realize the last thing they would want is to have no presence at all for an entire year. And that's going to be, that's the taffy pull, right? Because as you said, the owners control how much they're going to lose. And also I think the players with this bubble concept, I don't know if they buy into that. If you had to go to four different locations in the U.S. or three different locations and have these guys bubbled up, you know, for 6 months or something like that, even in a congested schedule, I'm not sure that flies. And so, and then on the backside of it, where would the sport be if there were no hockey until October of 2000 and what would it be then? 2022.
I think there will be hockey in October or November of 2021. I think they'll be hockey by then.
Okay. So yeah. you think that this, so basically what you're saying is that, they could start the season then as it normally would. Yeah. And then forsake this season.
I said this on the last podcast that we did, about a month ago. I said that the thing that really sticks with me, and I keep coming back to, is that the owners specifically, because people that have money don't like to lose money. So like they have all the money in the world. Like how many people in this country or in the world have all the money in the world and they're just going out giving it away? Not very few, very few. So the closer that these owners get to a place where it's like, okay, we can lose $50 million, $60, $70, $80 million this year, or we can just wait another 7 months and just gear everything back up to starting on time October of 2021, and maybe there are some cities that aren't completely at 100% capacity at that point, but soon at some point that we will be, you know, unobstructed and we're going to, you know, everything will be back on track. If you're of that mindset, and there are people that think that we're going to be dealing with COVID-19 well into 2022. But if you believe that with a vaccine and all that kind of stuff, if you believe that latter fourth quarter of 2021, that things will sort of be back to normal by then, whatever normal looks like at that point, when these owners start looking at that, and because you also got to take into account, what if you're on this stringent of a schedule that you need 60 games, 64 games, and a full playoff, plus, I mean, that the Olympics is a big deal because it's not just like NHL can broadcast their entire playoff or the Stanley Cup Finals on the USA Network, which is part of that that network, because the Olympics are on every NBC channel. They're on CSNBC, MSN. Like the Olympics use all of those platforms, so there won't be a place on NBC anyway for NHL hockey in July. So it's just not, it's a non-starter. They need to be done by July 4th. So if you take into account what some of these other leagues are dealing with, where you have a COVID outbreak on a team, because these teams and these players are going to be moving around. They're going to be going from city to city. They're going to be on planes. They're going to be in hotels. They're presumably, you're not going to be able to control these guys like you did in the bubble. So you're going to have COVID outbreaks. I mean, maybe, you know, I would assume that the professional athletes will be among the first people to get a vaccine, But the first people to get a vaccine are going to be healthcare workers. And probably sometime in February or March, your professional athletes will get them. But if
and
there's
you
a COVID outbreak,
shots.
And you need two shots, you got to that's the other thing about this. Like, you got to get, not only you got to get people to get the one, you got to get them to come back a month later and get the second dose. This is going to be a mess. But let's say there's a COVID outbreak in January, and there's three or four teams that are knocked out for a week or two. That throws your whole season into flux. And, I mean, it's going to be so tight if they're – I mean, I think I would leave some room for them to concede that maybe – I mean, maybe it goes down to 48. Maybe you're right. But it makes sense to me, especially if the – like, if you're the players and you're already conceding that 20% escrow you're never getting back. And then you have that 10% deferment that, you know, will come later. But – you don't want to concede any more salary. And if I'm a player, I don't want to concede any more salary. If the owners are adamant about having a season, then that's on them. If I'm a player, I'm already conceding all of the salary. Why would I concede any more of it? So if the players are going to get the rest of their salary, that other 70%, you're going to need to do as many games as possible. I don't think they can really go much fewer than 60.
Okay, so my little brain functions here properly. So basically, if you're going to start a season that really should have started in 2020, in early 2021, and finish it mid-2021, it has to start, as you say, because of the TV and everything else, it really has to start in January. So I say that's not going to happen. So then it becomes a question of how much the owners care about having a presence on TV or somewhere, it'll be on TV somewhere, in the winter, spring of 2021. That's the question. How much do they think it will hurt them the following year if they don't play at all? If I'm an owner, that's what I'm asking myself. Because, again, this is lose, lose more. That's the formula. Where what you're talking about is 100% correct. Smart business people, billionaires, multi-millionaires made their money by being smart, by not wanting to lose. And at some point, they all feel stupid when they lose. Even if it's $10 million a year, you know, the Blackhawks would never have had that run if Bill Wirtz didn't have a way to lose $20 million a year for a few years and be able to, you know, pass it off on different subsidiaries or whatever he was doing to make the pot right. He still took it in the shorts for quite a few years. A lot of owners, they don't want to do that, and they don't want to run an operation that's very difficult to make any profit at. You know, their carrot is the increased value of the franchise that they own someday. This is basically pretty much a break even, make a little bit, lose a little bit type of opportunity on a year-to-year basis for most teams. So that's the question. Because pragmatically, from what we know today, if this vaccine starts to become available to the general population, let's just say March, April, May, June, July, August, you would have 6 months of at least getting it into circulation for the general population. And that still might not enable to have people inside. We don't know. It's all guesswork. But, you know, maybe it won't be the beginning of October. Maybe it could be November 15th or even December 1st, where they could play a whole year. And at that point, they're not under the same restrictions with TV. Because, from a business standpoint, in many respects, hockey starts at the worst time of the year. Baseball playoffs, basketball gets going right around that time too. Football is already going. So So, you know, if you were wiping the slate clean, and this isn't my idea, this has been talked about on and off for years, if you were wiping the slate clean, you probably would want to start just after Christmas at some point. So the only thing you lose is those good crowds around the holidays when kids come home from school, but there's a lot less competition for you. You know, some of these states, even high school football, like in Texas and Dallas, they don't even want to play on a Friday night because of high school football. So it puts you in position to probably attract more eyeballs right away if the game started after Christmas. But that's another subject for another time. The question will be is if the owners want to forsake and relinquish and say, well, we'll have to take our chances that people will come back in and be energetic and enthused about a new season, even though we've been off TV for all this time. That's their risk. Otherwise, in many respects, it doesn't make sense. The other thing is, I don't see how they can't start, how they would be able to start, if not, but in some sort of a bubble situation, if they were going to start, let's just say by February.
Before we move on to Stan Bowman, I was talking to someone the other day, and, you know, I do believe that there's an appetite on both sides to have a season. The players want to have a season. They don't. I mean, think about this. I mean, a good chunk of the league hasn't really played much hockey at all since March. So there's a strong appetite to play, but there also is a realization that this thing is about to come to a head, and that it very, very may well veer off into an ugly place. And the suggestion that was made to me was that if it does go that way, where they get to an impasse, or the owners, start doing some fugazi where they're blaming the players, but it's actually the owners that pull the plug on this thing for the reasons that we've been talking about. That, and to your point about the league and the hockey, you know, having a presence, which is a big deal. I mean, there's no question about that. The suggestion was made to me was that the NHLPA would put together some sort of a World Cup of hockey, and, you know, potentially with the league involvement or not, that we're not going to go an entire winter without hockey was basically the suggestion, that in some form or another, hockey would appear on our televisions, but it just may not be in the form of an NHL season. There's also, I think that the NHL has, there's a lot of different things that the NHL is talking about. And the thing to me that is that it's pretty much all being kept under wraps. I mean, there's nothing really getting out unless it's the NHL, like, feeding it to their favorites in the media, you know, your Darren Dreggers and Scott Burnsides and stuff like that, Bob McKenzie, that there is the potential that you're going to have some sort of a truncated, like a really short season, like a playoff qualifier and then a playoff, because I mean there may not be any other option, but I think that's a last resort. But the point of all this is, and we do have to move on to Sam Bowman, that it all comes down to the next 2 weeks here, because certainly by Thanksgiving, which is only, I don't know, eight days away now, they're going to need to know, because they've got to get these players that are in Europe, they got to get them into the States, because for those teams that didn't participate in that fake playoff that they just did over the summer, their training camps will have to begin in early December.
Right. Otherwise, it's a recipe for disaster with injuries and stuff. And, you know, all these owners are well-heeled. Some are in better cash positions than others, I'm sure, just by the nature of the way business is. Kind of funny, there was something out on Twitter, and I'll rush through this for a minute. It had me chuckle, but a Dallas hotel is suing the Edmonton Oilers. They supposedly stiffed them on a bill two times last year, around $25,000 or so each time. you know, and so then the remarks come out, you know, well, Daryl Katz is, you know, he's worth $3.5 billion and this and that, you know. But I don't know. I don't know, you know, anything about anything concerning the fact that they're getting sued or why they didn't get paid or whatever. But I mean, ready cash being available, almost all these people have some shortfalls on their balance sheets because of what's come about. So I think, you know, we summarized it pretty good and it got long winded because there's a lot of parts to it, but it comes down to the money, and the players will have to give something probably. I mean, I don't see how else not they can't. I can't see how a season could go on and not be a full season without being some concession. And I don't think there could be a full season anymore, as you know, you've highlighted with the Olympics involved. So I think we're gonna know, you know, in the next few weeks as to what we'll be looking at and go from there.
Yep. And as a reminder, like all these owners, like they didn't get rich owning a hockey team. They got rich off other businesses, and for some of those owners, those other businesses are probably struggling now too.
Absolutely.
Okay, Stan Bowman. The Blackhawks, like I said, the Blackhawks sent out after a period of a bit of quiet. The draft went by. The Blackhawks traded Brandon Saad. Some fans flipped out about that. We'll talk about that in a second. But Stan Bowman, the Blackhawks put out a letter to their fans, season ticket holders, and basically said that we're in a rebuild. Everybody just relax. We're in a rebuild. Everything's fine. And proclaim that from now on, they're going to be transparent with the fans and the media. We're going to focus specifically on this, October 20th. Stan was on with Mark Lazarus and Scott Powers of The Athletic. And he started off with basically, I'm going to run through some of his quotes here. So here's the thing. I've got a theory about this, Al. when we talked about McDonough last podcast, and I think you were talking about some things you were hearing about maybe why things came to a head. I think we need to think about this a lot more in simplistic terms. For those of you that were around or paying attention back in the dark days of the early 2000s, the Blackhawks were being groomed by Bill Wirtz to be handed off to the younger son, Peter Wirtz. And that was always like that was in Bill Wirtz's mind. That was the way things were going to go. And Rocky Wirtz was the more successful son, but was, you know, in another line of business and was never really involved in anything with the hockey team. But the original succession plan put forth by the grandfather was assuming that Rocky, because he was the oldest son, would get the team when the time came. So when Bill Wirtz died, Rocky pulled a power play, stepped in front of Peter, and basically grabbed the team right out from under Peter Wirtz's feet. And now those two don't speak anymore. So I look at this as John McDonough served his purpose, and the team has obviously been on a decline. And they needed a scapegoat, and this is Danny Wirtz taking this team back and getting into sole possession of the Wirtz. And that, to me, is what this is all about. This is, you know, it's Danny Wirtz's time. Thank you, John. You did a great job, but we need someone to blame right now. Push him out. Now Danny Wirtz is the guy. I think the truth is much closer to that than anything else. I mean, there's other things. I mean, there's probably little, like when you're sort of sniffing around a story and trying to figure out, there's all these little nuggets that you find out. But I think big picture, that's more closer to what actually happened. And then Danny, in the aftermath of all that, senses or hears or reads all this vitriol towards Stan Bowman and has to figure out a different, you know, has to rosy it up a little bit. And obviously he believes, and for whatever reason, he believes that Stan Bowman is the guy. Obviously, Stan Bowman's been at the helm and was the GM during three Stanley Cup championships, so you got to give him credit for that. They're going with him. But they've got to give Stan, you know, they got to give Stan a little breathing room here, and this is what they came up with. Because, and the reason why that I believe that is because, like, at the very beginning of this podcast, when they start talking about transparency, Stan, who has never been a good public speaker, basically blurts it out from the very beginning, and that he says that the rebuild actually started a year or two ago. So, and that now his exact words is, this process is underway. It's been underway. The rebuild started a year or two ago, and now they're just being transparent about it. Those are Stan Bowman's words. And it's just like, I don't know that what they're doing now is any different than what they've been doing the past couple of years, but none of it is really a rebuild. I think that this is just, they're just trying to frame it to give Stan some breathing room here. This is the way I see it.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you said. And the other thing is that in your mind, could you picture John McDonough grooming someone for his job? No.
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Absolutely not. Okay. So, you know, he's got a reputation, and, you know, he's not a guy that, he doesn't play nice with other people for the most part, I think is a good way of putting it. He's the authority, and he wants to be in that position, and he's very good at that. So, yeah. And plus too, let's not forget, I don't know what the difference in salaries, but I mean, I would think the Hawks are a bit leaner without John McDonough. I don't know, you know, how much what time he had left on his contract, what the situation was or anything else. So that could have played into it too. This whole thing now is the letter. It was written appropriately. It spelled out what the Hawks wanted to spell out, but really when you read it, they would have been better off almost not saying anything. It's to placate the fans, to give them an excuse to lose going forward for an amount of time.
It was making the case for keeping the status quo.
Well, because they're stuck. Because let's talk about that for a second. Because they're stuck. When they were swept by Nashville a few years ago, that was the hard decision time. And what Stan Bowman did was he made a reactive, awful trade that if it wasn't for the fact that he's won three Stanley Cups, he would have been gone. And that's a trade that when you basically trade a Panarin, who by all accounts, unless he's the biggest liar in the world, had no desire to ever leave here, never pictured himself leaving here. When you trade an elite goal scorer like that, that's enough to basically ace-deuce you from ever getting another GM job in the NHL. Okay, that's a mistake. At the time, I kind of bought into it. Saad's a better all-around player and this and that. But what they overestimated, and they did it from then, and they kept doing it through the point of when they fired Joel Quenneville. When you have John McDonough, you know, speak up and go on the forefront of everything and say they're a playoff team, no doubt, I mean, the sirens had to go off. So now they're caught. They didn't trade a player that could have brought back a lot to them, who has a reasonable salary cap hit. If you wanted to blow it up, you trade Duncan Keith a couple of years ago. You could have been in position now. And I'm not being a backseat driver. I said it a couple of years ago. you would have been in a position now that you could have made a pitch for Pietrangelo or Torrey Krug if you had a plan. Now, that's saying that you're thinking Jonathan Toews, who did bounce back. See, the interesting thing now is the oldest players that make the most money outside of Brent Seabrook are your best players. And they've played like your best players the last 2 years. They have salaries now in context. They're overpaid because, you know, the $10 million contracts aren't going to be happening now because we've gone through a flat cap period and going forward the same type of deal. And even before the flat cap, it didn't escalate as much as many thought it would. So now you're in a position where Jonathan Toews, could first ballot Hall of Fame player, if you had to go to a Stanley Cup final, I think he's on the short list of centers you'd want on your team, even at his age. Who's going to take him for $10.5 million for that type of cap hit? You lose every Patrick Kane trade you lose, at least for the foreseeable future, which means a lot of
Please stop. And if you see anyone, I'm talking to the people listening, if you see anyone on the internet suggesting trading Patrick Kane, please tell them to stop.
Yeah, he's still one of the best players in the league. And you lose, there's a saying that the team that trades the best player away usually loses, and that's almost always the case. And in this case, no doubt. And plus, this isn't like, you know, you're shuffling off Boardwalk and Park Place and buying a few railroads and trying to make your pot right with your money or whatever else. If you send $10 million out, you're going to be taking back some of that salary, a good portion of it. And that's where the math doesn't work. So now they're stuck. So I listened to a little bit. Well, let's not jump all over. But that letter basically tries to placate the fans. The organization needs the media when they're bad.
Right.
Otherwise, you're basically holding on to their coattails covering the team. And, you know, basically they control, the media is controlled in many respects all the way around. But in hockey, the teams control the media. You can't get an audience with Stan Bowman in November if you want to talk to him. You know, it's all regimented. Even if you see walking through the hallways, you're not going to be able to get any kind of comment.
I've been saying this for years, and the Blackhawks, I didn't go out to Rockford last year because I just didn't do it. But, you know, the Blackhawks were nice. I guess they didn't ever get in the way of me having access to a certain extent in Rockford or with the team or with the organization. But there were lines that I wasn't able to cross, and I always thought it was ridiculous because if you want positive press, this is not a secret. If you want positive press, talk to the press. Like, if you want your voice in that media person, that writer's article, you got to talk to them. And that's the way you control your narrative. Is even if you talk to the writer and they don't agree with you, or, you know, if they're being responsible, if the journalist is being responsible, they're still including your words, your voice in their article. And that's just something that they haven't seen it that way, and maybe they're seeing it differently now. But I've always said I just don't understand why they don't talk to the media, or they don't, you know, even if it's on background. You know, I would get stuff on background all the time, but I wasn't able to talk to certain people on the record. And I always thought that it was ridiculous because, you know, background's a different story. But I want to go through, because we don't have that much time. So on Corey Crawford, Stan Bowman was looking for a one-year deal. This is some of the stuff is enlightening, but it's not exactly surprising. He knew that Corey Crawford wouldn't want a one-year deal, so they made their decision. Again, it all goes to what we talked about last podcast. It's like, if you knew that you weren't going to sign the guy and you were going to offer him something that he didn't want, why did you wait until the day before free agency to tell him. Like, it just, it's so ridiculous. And it's one of those
right.
things that makes this organization just so unlikable. And if they're going to, it's one thing to be transparent with the media. It's another just to, you know, just to be decent people. Then he went on to talk about the three goalies, and he noted that Colin Dealey, Kevin Lankinen, and Malcolm Subban are all around the same age that Corey Crawford was when Crawford came to the NHL. That's not exactly correct. Crawford baked in the minors for a while, but he did say that he's not saying that those guys are of Corey's caliber or that they'll replicate Corey Crawford's career, but he did note that, and he's he has to say what – I mean, these – I mean, it would – if the Blackhawks were able to find their guy in one of those three, then they're off to a good start. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I mean, I think Colin Dealey has shown flashes. Kevin Lankinen is okay. I don't know that he translates to the NHL, but we'll see. I don't think Malcolm Subban – I think at this point you know what Malcolm Subban is. He's a backup. But that was that. And then if you recall, Jonathan, after the Brandon Saad trade, Jonathan Toews was not happy. I think he talked to Mark Lazarus. And this was enlightening. So Stan Bowman commented on Toews being upset post-Saad. Saad trade, and this is Stan Bowman's quote. I've tried to explain to them what we're doing now isn't different from what we've been doing. We're just being more open and transparent about it. Now, it's one thing to be like to the fans, and this is why I just don't buy this transparency thing. It's one thing to be like, oh yeah, we were telling the fans that we think we're contenders and we're really positive, and then a year later going, you know what, actually, that was just all hype and we're really in a rebuild. It's another to not be honest with the players or be upfront with the players behind the scenes, because it's not like these guys leaked to the media. I mean, it'd be one thing if you had a player that. Like Robin Leonard that loved to sit in front of a microphone, for 25 minutes after a game. I mean, these other guys aren't like that. So, like, why not be up front with Brent Seabrook and Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane about what's going on? That was this quote here was very enlightening to me, that we've tried to explain to those guys that what we're doing now isn't different from what we've been doing. We're just being more open and transparent about it. I was gobsmacked by that.
Well, seeing that we're running short on time, and interestingly enough, Theo Epstein just stepped down as president of the baseball operations for the Cubs. What's the chances of McDonough going back there? But that's another podcast for another time, maybe. But I just listened to most of the Colleton, Lazarus, and Powers podcast. And interesting, when he talks, right away, the youngest team in the league, youngest team in the playoffs. We're not wiping it clean and just going all young, but we want to get help for the older players. We need to get deeper. And those guys do a good job of asking questions. But again, you could only pull so many answers. On this whole dog and pony show with Stan Bowman, never once did he say, we've done a bad job of developing players, which is exactly why they're where they're at. Because the teams that stayed good and, eventually you drop off, but the third and fourth line players, the role players, the bottom six forwards, the guys that know how to play both sides of the puck that Colleton says they need more of, those players are the type of players you can get in a draft because you're drafting towards the end because you're making the playoffs every year and doing well. Well, the Hawks have gotten lucky, beating the bushes in Europe and with Kubalik, it looks like, and the Brinkett fell into their lap and they had the guts to take him, but they could take the chance taking a smaller guy then because he showed up, he was higher rated on their board, and that's what they do. But the fact of the matter is there's been no development here, so you put yourself in a position where every mistake stands out so much. Brent Seabrook's contract, this and that and the other thing. And what Colleton says – and, he's going to play the younger players. and he might even have him on the ice in the last couple of minutes of the game. And he kind of alludes to the fact that the older players need to get used to this. And this goes back to what I said the last time, and even before we talked on Twitter, when this comes apart, if it comes apart, when it comes apart, you'll know, because you'll see the playing time of the big guys go down. More importantly, the playing times in crucial situations. You start seeing Duncan Keith not on the ice in the last 2 minutes. Okay, once, happens again, there's a conversation behind closed doors with that. Make no mistake. You see Kane's minutes go down from 22, 23, 24, down to 19, 18. Maybe okay for a game or two. Otherwise, there's a conversation. Same thing with Taves. So it's almost like now they're basically, you know, they're hoping they get lucky and that they could cobble something together. And Colleton admitted they needed more players that play both sides of the puck, been saying that forever, because whatever he tries to do doesn't work defensively because they don't have the know-how by enough players to implement anything. So when they picked up the players that they did, Wallmark, Janmark, those type of players, that's what they're looking to do. And Lazarus and Powers said, well, did you need to do that because, you know, now you have young goalies that are unproven? Well, yeah, but they needed to do it anyway. Because if you look at the situation, they give up more high-danger chances than just about anybody. They had probably in the top three of the tandems in goaltending, and they still finished where they were finished. I mean, you know, they still were barely above 500. They finished with 72 points in 70 games. So they're now we're in a position where this is going to be like purgatory, or they get lucky, or the yarn ball comes apart sooner than later. And I don't know where they go if that were to happen, because if these guys get disgusted, the big guys, and want out, they're going to be for sale signs that are flashing around their neck. They're not going to be easy to deal. And
it's a
tough situation now.
Yeah, later in the podcast, Lazarus, I believe, asked Stan about no movement clauses, and obviously the Big Four have no movement clauses. And Stan, he asked if he's ever asked them or is considering asking them about waiving. And I mean, what is Stan going to say? But he did, his exact quote is, "Not right now, I am not."
Right.
In regards to asking.
Right.
So, moving
and,
along.
And you know as well as I do, everyone has those no movement clauses of the better players on a team. And it just comes down to a point where most of them do move unless they're in their last year and they don't care about winning a cup as much as some others. Here you have a situation where these guys are very comfortable here. Duncan Keith he's been underpaid for years because he took the lifetime contract. And then you have the other guys who they've already won three cups, you know. Yeah, they're winners. They want to compete, but you know they could stick it to the team and say no, we're not going anywhere. So, like I say, it's interesting times. And if they think they're getting the short end of the stick here, and they're getting pushed out the door slowly, and they're not being upfront with them, management isn't. You know, they could just dig their heels in and stick it out till their contract expires.
Yeah, so the Brandon Saad trade, which is, for whatever reason, is a source of consternation for Blackhawks fans. I don't know how much more evidence you need now that Brandon Saad just isn't that good. A lot of people like, well, how come they didn't trade for draft picks? And how come they didn't get more for Brandon Saad? Could it be that there's just not that much of a market for Brandon Saad? But it is some of...
Yes.
For
$6.5 million or $6 million, there isn't that much market
with
for
one
a guy that
left.
Scores 20 goals. Yeah,
right. And in fairness, it's six million for a guy that's going to be a UFA in a season that you're not even sure that's going to happen, or how much of it there's going to be. But still, they couldn't trade him last year either. Anyway, because remember last year they were we know now that last year they were rebuilding too. Okay. Allegedly. So Stan Bowman here. The key here is Zadorov, the defenseman that they got from Colorado. And if you really listen to what Stan is saying, this was an important trade for him because, and I don't necessarily disagree. It's the way I react to this trade is the way that I looked at the Nick Jalmerson trade back a few years ago. It was the right time to trade Nick Jalmerson. Was the return the correct return? I mean, as it turned out, no. I mean, Connor Murphy wasn't the right guy. But it wasn't the wrong time to make that deal. Nick Jalmerson had a lot of miles on him. You needed to get younger at one of those top three – excuse me, one of those top three defensive positions. It was the right trade. It was the wrong return, as it turned out. This trade is something similar. Either Zadorov is going to be a good get for Bowman, and that's a notch in his belt, or this was – I mean, he's hinging a lot, and he's talking about – this is Stan Bowman, his quote. In this case, I think we have a high hope that Zadorov is going to bring an element to our team that we haven't had for a while with his skill set. He's a tough kid. He's a very tough kid. Doesn't back down from anybody. Plays a defensive game, and I think he's a really good partner for these young defensemen that we want to take the next step forward. What he's saying, and he continued on, what he's saying is that he expects, this is important, that Zadorov is going to be partnered with Mitchell or Boqvist. And Stan Bowman also said in this podcast that had Mitchell come out a year ago, he expected that Mitchell would have made the team, would have made the Hawks a year ago. So your top two pairings now are pretty clear. It's Keith and Zadorov on the left side. It's Mitchell and Boqvist on the right. And then your third pair is whatever your third pair is going to be. Is it going to be DeHaan and Seabrook or Murphy or some, you know? And then, you know, Stan Bowman also seems pretty high on Wyatt Kalinuk, but that kid's never – he's coming right out of college. He's going to have to go to Rockford, but he kept bringing up Kalinuk's name. So this is obviously as important of a trade as Stan is going to make for the foreseeable future.
I think they have to – I think whenever this shakes out, I think they have to look – they have to be looking to trade either DeHaan or – well, I would have traded DeHaan before Mata. But they have to trade either DeHaan or probably Murphy to make what you say make sense, unless they're really going to just shelve. Seabrook has no chance of even playing, like, you know, two-thirds of the games or whatever. It seems like that might be a play that they're going to do. And then even they could go swing back around. And you know what? People laugh about it. There's nothing wrong with Cuckoo for $1 million or $800,000 or whatever you could get him for. He was reliable enough. Him and Mata played pretty well together. The other thing is listening to Colleton real quick. You know, the more he talks, the more, you know, the more you could glean little things. And they were talking about, you know, forcing Nylander into the lineup and go, well, you know, how many times was he scratched? Well, it really wasn't that many. And what Colleton doesn't take ownership of is when you put him up on the top line, that disenfranchises another line. You know, that makes the third line have Strom and DeBrincat on it. Okay? They're not covering anybody. DeBrincat should have been in place of Nylander on the top line. Strom is another guy. He doesn't fit because what Colleton said is they tried to use him at wing so that they could get, you know, get him in more of an offensive mode, have him play with Kirby, this and that, and that didn't work. They went away from it. So to me, I don't see Strom starting the year, and I would think that maybe one of those other defensemen. And there should be a market for those guys, especially Murphy, unless they're both kind of injury prone is the deal. I don't see why you would want to hold on to both of them, but I think that could happen. Sorry to interject on what the lineup's going to look like when we don't even know when there's going to be a lineup to look at.
Well, quickly. So, you know, they've obviously acquired some players. They want to play young players, but in regards to two older players that are still on the roster, Bowman gave updates on Zach Smith. He said Zach Smith, as of right now or a month ago, wasn't cleared to play, but he expected that by the time that a season were to begin, hypothetically, that Smith would be ready. And then he also talked about Andrew Shaun. I thought this was interesting. He basically threw his hands up in the air and they said, you got to ask Andrew. But Lazarus asked him point blank, if Andrew Shaw is healthy and he's playing well, will he play? And Bowman said his actual response was sure. But I mean, I don't know what you take out of that.
You would think both of those guys aren't going to be on the roster one way or the other, but he can't buy out anybody. So it's long-term IR stuff or whatever. You know what I mean? It's one of those situations, I would think. You know, real quick again, because we're running out of time and we have to learn to do this in an hour, and that may take another 10 years. But
we have a few extra.
The fact of the matter is that, you know, supposedly, and I have to believe it's true, these guys like Kujula, when they asked him about his concussions and, you know, that he was coming back and he had quite a few, and he said, well, he goes, you know, what the doctors tell me, they don't show any long-term damage already there or anything like that. You would imagine that they're looking at brain scans and this and that, especially now. You know, you can't keep this stuff closeted. It has to all be out there, you know. And it's not a situation where a guy has three concussions in a short period of time and he keeps getting okayed to play, you know, like the Steve Matador thing. And that remains to be seen if the Blackhawks were wrong then or not. But I'm saying, though, I would think Andrew Shaw has a determination to make. Corey Crawford made the determination that if you come back like he did, you know, and then he got another concussion, he was going to come back again. That's what he feels. That's what's best for him. So it's kind of one of those things where a player has to have that resolve where I don't think a player could come back and say, well, if I get one more concussion, I'm going to retire. It's almost like if there's enough damage already, it doesn't go away. You have to make a decision. Is it worth the risk? And I think, you know, maybe that isn't an etched in stone for Andrew Shaw. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and again, we have a couple more minutes and then we got to go, but, furthermore on the big four contracts, basically Taves, Kane, Keith, and Seabrook, Stan Bowman, quote, I think they have a lot of value to our team. They're still good players, but the league is changing. And then when he talked about the cap, he said the cap is flat and young players don't make a lot of money. So that is how you make the mathematical puzzle work. He's talking about the issues that he has in improving the team really there. I think he's not incorrect, but the one thing that he's choosing to ignore there is part of the mathematical puzzle these days. And the reason why the league keeps getting younger and younger, other than the fact that it just keeps getting faster and faster, is that younger players get paid much, much earlier than they ever did before.
Because
the younger
the
players
sooner.
Are making,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah, they get in, well, they get in the league sooner. And like, look at Taves and Kane. Teams are identifying their core, you know, their core players, and they're getting them under contract, big money, long term, much sooner than they ever were before. It used to be that, you know, in the NHL, that you didn't get your big payday until you were 27. Now you get it when you're 23, 24. That's huge. I mean, that's what's really changed the league more so. What else? Did
that squeezes
say here?
That squeezes the middle class,
right?
Because you have top, right? You're tipped to the bigger guys that are tied up because that's what you need to do, and then you need to fill in around them with the minimum to $1.2 to $1.5 million players. So $6 million for a guy that plays, you know, that scores 20 goals, that's kind of a third line, maybe second line player, that doesn't work. So. Yeah, and, you know, if you look at what they have now, they've got $8.5 million or close to it tied up in two defensemen. You know, that when they get good, if they're going to get good in the foreseeable future, one or both won't be with them in DeHaan and Murphy. So that's another one, you know.
Right, and your point about the middle class. I mean, look at two guys that the Blackhawks just acquired, Lucas Wallmark and Matthias Janmark. Those are two guys with 1-year deals. So, and they, you know, Wallmark I think is $950,000, Janmark's a little over $2 million. But those are two guys that are probably, I mean, if you were to project it out over a full season, I mean, they're going to come between 10 and 20 goals. They're going to be fine players, you know, but they're not going to be spectacular. They'll probably add some defensively, but at the end of that year, you're probably not going to re-sign them. There's not going to be a big market for them, and one or two of those players is going to wind up in Europe the following year. That's what happens players.
Well, you know, and the other thing, too, is the one that you really like, you could get them for $1.5 million the following year, for 2 years probably, because they don't have the leverage. I mean, that's what it seems like to me. I mean, the one kid comes from Dallas that was the best defensive team in the league, and he was playing significant minutes there. So unless, you know, he comes here and for whatever reason forgets how to play, those are players that they need. But they're not going to be making $4.5 million. They're going to be making 1.5 or 2. So that's where the squeeze is going to come, and it's already starting to happen because that's just the way it is. So, and then you got to hope that when you do sign that kid out of the entry level contract, and you don't, instead of paying him 3.5 or 4, you pay him 8 because or 7 because you're tying him up. You best hope you don't make a mistake. So it's an interesting one all the way around.
All right, and to wrap up here, and I think these are appropriate. We're fast forwarding here in the interview because we're out of time, but. I think it was Lazarus asked Stan about like the angst out in Twitter and the fandom and the sentiment that the fans want Stan Bowman fired, to which Stan responded, I'm not trying to make a pitch to satisfy people, Mark. Now, that was just so – that's what this whole thing is about.
But I'm transparent.
That's what this whole thing –
I'm going to be
this
transparent.
This whole thing is about. But he, all right, Stan continues on. I'm not trying to say I'm perfect or that every decision we made was the right one. Not every decision we made panned out. That's on me. So that's as close as he got to admitting fault. We're not satisfied, but we do have some good things going for us. We're not starting from scratch. I agree with him there. I mean, there's no question about that. He continues on. We have to do a better job of explaining what we're doing. That's the problem, right? That's the problem. Stan goes on. Going forward, we can hopefully do a better job lessening some of the angst if we can explain this a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the problem has been all along. Not that you can't, like, you haven't been able to develop players. Not that you fell in love with a coach that was meddling in his first season in the AHL. You sent a bunch of veterans there with AHL experience, winning AHL experience, and you made a playoff run, and then you anointed him the NHL coach, and now it's not working out well. You say that he's good with younger players. You say that he gets the most out of his players, but he's not really not. Like, so
he loves him. Loves Colleton. He loves him. And if I listen to the Colleton podcast, and he came here because he wanted to learn from Joel, and now he gets phone calls and mentoring from Scotty Bowman. So it's quite the situation, you know. And Colleton is either going to turn in 3 years, he's going to be thought of as one of the best coaches in the league, or he'll be in Europe. There's no in between.
Because
they're going to give him so much rope. They're going to give him so much rope. They're going to sign him again because they'll get him at a very reasonable price. They'll sign him again. He'll be here probably, and he talks like he's going to be here for another 3 years. So he's going to have a lot of time to learn, and now we'll see what happens. But from where I sit, you know, he's behind the curve. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, because of the choice that Stan made, Stan's married to Colleton, for better or worse. If he were to fire or move on from Colleton, then it puts even more pressure on Stan. I mean, to whatever that would mean. I mean, it appears that Danny Wirtz is all in on Stan. But I mean, I personally, you know, in my experience with Jeremy Colliton, I like talking to him. I think he's a good guy, but I do think that, you know, what he's really, really good at is kind of kissing up. Like, let's just say that. He knows how to, he's a good politician, I think, you know, in a hockey.
He knows
hockey
his sense. Place. He knows his place,
yeah.
Chris. And I mean, yeah. And I think he's probably a guy you'd want to have a beer with, talk hockey with or whatever. But I mean, whatever he's tried to implement here really hasn't worked. I don't see it. You know, they want to give him credit for Kirby Dach. Would Kirby Dach have played those minutes in the playoffs if they weren't off for months before that? You know, I'd like to see Kirby Dach take another step forward. I think they seem to pump him up a lot. And like E.J. Raddick said on NHL Network when Quenneville got fired, and this was his comment, not mine. He says, now they have someone that they could tell what to do. And that's because
exactly.
there's a handful of coaches that you're really not going to tell them what to do. You could go out and trade for Antoine Vermette because you think he's going to be taking faceoffs, and then he spends the next 6 weeks playing wing. You know, Joel Quenneville could do that, not Jeremy Colliton. So, like, when they go, it's a collaboration, and he keeps bringing that up, too, when he talks. It's a collaboration. It's a collaboration, but he knows his place in the room. So they have it fixed the way they want to fix it. They want it to be fixed, and it should be in order. And I expect that if a season starts or something, they could announce an extension, and they may do it sooner than later so that no one will, the second guessing will be even less because they won't give it an opportunity for their record to come into play, and they could do that. You know, and I think that's what's probably going to happen.
All right, Al, I kept it a little bit too long, but thank you. At Al Smagley on Twitter. I am at Chris Block on Twitter. I don't do it very much anymore, but I am there. If you're trying to get a hold of me or ask me a question, that would be a place to do it. This felt good, and maybe we'll do it again. There'll be plenty to talk about, I'm sure. But until next time, Al, thank you very much.
Good to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
All right. Well, if I don't talk to you, you be well, and everybody be kind to each other out there. I don't see very much kindness going on out in the world today. I think the great American experiment is failing before our very eyes, but we have hope. We have hope. And
just one last thought. Don't shoot the messenger.
Don't shoot the messenger. Good night, everybody, or good day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.